If you were to think about what life would be like today if there were no satellites orbiting Earth, you might be shocked by what we would be missing. Nearly all of our ways of communicating and navigating our way through daily life would be entirely different. Today on Please Explain, we're going to learn about satellites, and to explain are Dr. Jonathan McDowell, an astrophysicist at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, part of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Dr. Laura Grego, an astrophysicist and senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she focuses on the technology and policy implications of space weapons. She's the co-author of Securing the Skies and the Physics of Space Security. And we also invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Laura, isn't the idea of satellites an old one? Can you tell us a bit about the history of the realization of satellite technology before the launch of Sputnik?
The launch of Sputnik, October 4th, 1957, was a watershed moment. For sure.
It opened the space age, they say.
It opened the space age, and it changed perceptions about what was possible for humans and what part of the world was ours. And I think it brought humans into space in a way that we hadn't thought about before. And after that, it was a rapid leap into space. The time between the first Sputnik launch and the first animal launch into orbit was just a month. And before 2 years were up, the first weather satellite was launched, and an object had reached the moon. So humans were really ambitious in the late 1950s to get out into space.
Well, at that point, it was the Soviet Union mostly. Was the United States even considering a space program at that time?
Yeah, but the United States also launched satellites at the same time. We're not first, to the chagrin of many people, but it was certainly a very competitive peer relationship at that point.
Sputnik was put into an elliptical low Earth orbit. Is that where most of the satellites are located?
Today?
Yeah.
Most satellites today? About half of satellites that are currently operating today are in low Earth orbit. So there's something in the neighborhood of 1,000 satellites that are actively operating, and about half of are in low Earth orbits, and about just shy of half are in the most distant orbits, the geosynchronous, and then a bit in the middle.
Now, Jonathan, doesn't your website, planet4589.org, provide the most comprehensive historical list of satellite launch information starting with Sputnik?
That's certainly what I claim, yes.
You claim it. Do we know for sure? Because Laura said that there are about 1,000 up there. I've read anywhere from 900 to over 3,000, which is a huge variance. So why such a big gap?
You've got to distinguish between satellites that are working right now and dead satellites. So when a satellite stops working, it doesn't fall out of the sky. It keeps on as an artificial moon orbiting the Earth. So right now, there are about 3,500 satellites in orbit, but only about 1,000 of those are still working.
And they keep on orbiting until some of them wind up falling from the sky. What determines that?
Right. Well, if you're in a low orbit, even though you're out in space, there's still a little bit of thin atmosphere there. And so and you're orbiting around the Earth at about 18,000 miles an hour. So if you imagine, you know, you're going down the freeway, you stick your head out the car window at that speed, you're going to have quite a headwind. And that slows the satellite down, and it spirals ever closer to the Earth. And as it gets closer, the atmosphere gets denser, and eventually the thing just melts and burns up. So that's why satellites re-enter. But if you're way out in space, like the geostationary satellites that Laura mentioned, they will stay up for millions of years. There's just not enough atmosphere out there to slow them down.
How sophisticated was Sputnik beyond the fact that it was a technological first? Didn't it also do other things, like help identify the upper atmospheric layer's density, provide data on radio signal distribution in the ionosphere, and also give us the first, it's the first one, but also the first opportunity for meteoroid detection?
Well, I don't think it did much for meteoroids, but it did. It was really a very simple satellite, and certainly the Soviet Union spun it as best it could. But it just had a little thermometer on board, and observations of its orbit let us understand how dense the upper atmosphere was, how quickly it took, how long it took for Sputnik to re-enter gave us a lot of clues. So really the science program, and I think, you know, in the early days, you're quite right that the Soviet Union had a lot of the spectaculars, but most of the detailed science was done by the United States satellites.
Laura, how many different types of satellites are there?
You can think of them in categories. The primary function, about just over half, maybe 60% of satellites that are operating right now are communications satellites. And one useful, particularly useful thing about satellites, especially those that are geostationary, which mean they more or less appear that's in the sky like they don't move. It's a great way to broadcast a signal widely over a large area on the Earth. So that is well matched to what satellites can do, and so that's a large portion of what we do with satellites. There's also in low Earth orbit a good number of Earth observation satellites, so things that are that will provide high resolution maps, just like you'd pull up in Google Maps, weather satellites, those that are monitoring the health of the Earth, the environmental monitoring. There are also satellites that provide navigation signals, and probably the most familiar to listeners would be global positioning system satellites.
Did they all look the same, or would I be able to spot, if I were up there, would I be able to say, oh, that's a GPS satellite, oh, that's a communication satellite, oh, that's a TV satellite? Well, that one is military.
Well, from looking at a satellite, from the way a satellite looks, you can tell something about what it does. For example, if it has a big, you know, radio communications dish, or, you know, a great number of them pointed to different areas on the Earth, you can imagine that's probably a broadcast satellite. If it has a large telescope that looks like, you know, maybe the Hubble telescope, but it's pointed back toward the Earth, that's either a commercial imaging satellite or a U.S. military spy satellite. They also do astrophysics, and both Jonathan and I have worked on satellites that, for example, the Chandra satellite, that can access parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that you just can't from the Earth. So that's another important use of satellites, getting up above the atmosphere able to do science from there.
And I want to come back to that satellite in a little while, but right now I think we're kind of dealing with the basics. Yeah. And Jonathan, Laura mentioned that some of these satellites look like they're motionless above us. Does that involve geosynchronicity?
That's exactly right. So if you have a satellite that's in low orbit, it goes around the entire Earth in only an hour and a half at 18,000 miles an hour. But as you go higher and higher, it takes longer and longer for the satellite to go around, because the moon takes a whole month to go around. And so there's a point, which is about 23,000 miles up, where it takes exactly 24 hours to go around the Earth. So if you whiz around the equator and take 24 hours to do it, as the Earth spins beneath you, you stay above exactly the same point on the Earth, and that's what you've suddenly made a television tower 23,000 miles high. So it's a very useful orbit.
But it must be kind of difficult to be able to get the satellite launched to the exact right spot. Is it a matter of how much fuel you put in the rocket?
Well, that's right. So you use intermediate orbits. You pop the satellite into a low orbit around the Earth, and then you boost it again to get it higher, and then you make small corrections with little rocket engines until you've got it going at exactly the right height and speed. And so you need to have a feedback where you track the orbit of the satellite, figure out where it is, how far off it is, and then make those small corrections.
So how do we prevent them from colliding with each other or being damaged by space trash or space debris?
That's a really increasing problem. We have an ecological problem now in space, just as we do on Earth. And in the old days, you just relied on the fact that space is big. And typically, satellites are hundreds of miles apart. The chances are not that great of them hitting each other. But as the amount of space junk has increased, we've seen more and more cases of minor damage to satellites. And then recently in 2009, we had two full-fledged satellites do a head-on collision and smash themselves into thousands of pieces. So it's starting to be a real problem. More and more satellites nowadays have maneuvering engines on them. In the old days, you just put a satellite up and it couldn't change its orbit. Now it can dodge if you get enough warning. So people are making some progress on this, but it's an increasing problem.
So,
I would add to that is the fact that, as you mentioned, Jonathan, once you're up there, you don't come down at most orbits. That's the same for space trash or space debris. So if your satellite breaks up while in orbit and it's not at one of those low orbits that's subject to wind drag, you'll be up there with all of those thousands and thousands of pieces.
But, Laura, Jonathan just suggested that we're developing ways to control them more once they are in orbit. How long does that last?
The ability to control a satellite?
Yeah. I'm sure they have batteries or other things that allow them to keep functioning for a long time. But we hear about them suddenly losing contact with Earth. Is that because we did something wrong?
Well, that's right. So the way that we control satellites is having a radio signal from the ground and telling it what to do. And the satellite itself will have some kind of power source, usually solar panels. That's a source of its power, and it'll have some batteries, and it'll have some a gas tank, basically a fuel that allows it to move around, but eventually the gas tank depletes. And space is a fairly hostile environment. It's high radiation, as we mentioned, lots of tiny pieces of space debris, and eventually, it's tricky. A satellite may fail. Sometimes they, and although we're actually pretty well practiced at it after 50 years in space, not every satellite makes it, lights up when it gets into orbit. And so sometimes they get up there and they still have their full fuel tank and they never establish contact with the ground.
Do we know which one is the oldest that's still functioning?
Well, there are a couple up there from the 1970s. I think there's one from 1974 and one from 1978. And then the normal lifespan for a satellite is probably, 10 to 15 years. That's what they would estimate. But sometimes, even after its normal functions have ceased, there's still something that you can use it for. And one of those two, I think, is now more or less a communications link for the South Pole. It doesn't do its – I think it might have been a weather satellite, and I'm sure Jonathan knows the
right.
details
this
of it.
This is GOES-3, yeah. Which is an old weather satellite that's now being given to the National Science Foundation as a communications link to the folks down at the polar station. And the other one, which is even older, it dates from 1974. It's amazing because it was built by amateurs, amateur radio enthusiasts who shared a piggyback ride to orbit with this little ham radio transponder, and they're still operating it today.
We're talking about satellites on today's Please Explain with Dr. Jonathan McDowell, an astrophysicist at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, and Dr. Laura Grego, an astrophysicist and senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Jonathan, if we're looking into the night sky, how might we recognize that something is a satellite?
Well, you'll see it moving across the sky. And it's hard to describe how it's different from an airplane. Obviously, if you have seen a little flashing light, that's probably just an airliner. But if it's moving very steadily, and then it often a good clue is if it fades away and becomes invisible, that's a satellite that has just moved into the Earth's shadow. Because satellites don't shine on their own. You're seeing the reflected sunlight off them. And if it moves into the shadow, it just winks away. There's a great website called heavensabove.com where you can find out what satellites are going over your location tonight. So that's a great way to spot satellites. When the International Space Station comes over, it's really, really bright. It's really worth going out and seeing.
A listener, AJ from Brooklyn, asks, how much redundancy is there among these satellites that are so critical to Earth systems that we take for granted? Are we vulnerable to catastrophic failure in communication or other systems, or could a single failure trigger cascading failures?
Well, you know, there's a couple ways we get redundancy. Typically, every major satellite has a double or triple redundancy in most of its major systems, so that if one part of it breaks, one widget breaks, there's another widget to take over. And then we have the constellations of these satellites, so if an entire satellite fails, there's another satellite to take its place. So nowadays, most of the major systems are pretty robust. The worry, perhaps, is that if you have an enormous solar flare or some other big natural disaster, that could take out a lot of satellites at once with a big wave of radiation, and that could be a problem.
Now, Laura, is there an international governing organization that supervises satellite traffic?
No, in fact, there isn't. There's not an equivalent of air traffic control in space. It's ad hoc for the most part. That's something that nations are trying to get sorted out. The United States has by far the most resources with which to track satellites. We have the Space Surveillance Network, which is a network of radars and optical telescopes and other assets that we use to keep track of all of those tens of thousands of objects up in the sky. And there's a part of that that provides there are services that provide a warning that two satellites or a satellite and a piece of debris may be headed for a collision. But there isn't really a formal system saying, well, you take the right and I'll take the left and we'll go around each other. There isn't this formal sense of, communication channels between satellite owners. Some of that has, organically happened between commercial satellite operators where they have developed a system of trying to limit interference. But we're right at the cusp of trying to bring the international community to consensus on a system that can kind of solve this problem. It's a bit Wild West right now with technology racing a bit ahead of our legal system. So you're actually asking the right question right now.
And is there is it also an ad hoc approach to how the satellites are sent up? Are they usually sent up with rockets that are supplied by the U.S. government, or can anybody send up a satellite?
Well, that's actually a great question. It is, although more than 50 countries may own a satellite or a large share in satellites, that's quite different from the ability to actually put a satellite into orbit independently. Jonathan and I have talked about a list of those countries. Some countries have had it and have given it up, but somewhere around 10 or 11 countries have the actual independent ability to put satellites up into orbit, and Iran was the last to demonstrate that. North Korea hopes to do so in a week or so. The technological sophistication that's required to lift a satellite up to not only up to the altitudes where satellites are, so those are hundreds of miles above the Earth's surface. So some of them, low Earth orbit satellites, are not so much farther than the distance between me and you right now, Leonard. But they need to go at these enormous speeds, 18,000 miles per hour. So to get the energy going, to get a satellite moving that quickly to stay into orbit takes technical sophistication and the amount of control you need to get it in just the right direction in the right spot has limited that Space Launch Club to, under a dozen countries.
Well, we're pretty far from each other. You're in Cambridge, Mass. I'm here in New York City. Jonathan, Laura mentioned that Iran and North Korea now can launch satellites. What kind of satellites would they be launching? Would they be communication satellites or would they be military satellites?
Well, in the first instance, they're launching just very simple technological satellites that are checking out the ability to have a radio transmitter that can communicate with its mission control, just to show that they can build a satellite at all. The next step for these countries, and North Korea may or may not have the capability yet, is to put cameras on these satellites and have an independent spy satellite capability. That really seems to be most of what's driving the developing countries, and particularly the ones that aren't on good terms with the West. So Iran recently launched one of its first observation satellites. It's not really a spy satellite yet because the cameras don't take sharp enough pictures to be militarily useful, but they're moving along that track.
Now, Laura, when Sputnik was launched, there were fears that a satellite would be used to launch an attack or could be used to launch an attack on Earth. Was that just Cold War hysteria?
Well, I think the more salient point of that was the recognition that the ability to put a satellite into orbit, the technology that you use for rocket launchers is nearly identical to ballistic missile launchers. So the ability to put a satellite into orbit also indicated the ability to send an intercontinental ballistic missile. And in the case of during the Cold War, armed with a nuclear weapon from the Soviet Union to the United States. So, and that is, again, a similar concern that one has with North Korea, that the indication that their attempts to put a satellite into orbit also furthers along their ballistic missile program, which, you know, was a concern to a number of countries.
Well, during the talk about creating our Star Wars program, one of the proposals was that we would have satellites in space that would then be able to shoot down a missile that was aimed at the United States.
That's right.
Is that kind of technology feasible?
It isn't. So that was back in 1984, too, and we're not much closer to putting lasers in space to shoot down ballistic missiles.
Or so, somebody else's satellite?
Now, we are closer to it. So you can think of space weapons in a couple of different categories, but one is weapons that are based in space or are satellites themselves, and that was a lot of the conception of the Star Wars missile defense program. And those weapons could target ballistic missiles, and they could target targets on the ground. Another category, though, is also weapons that could be used to attack satellites, and those, you can do that pretty straightforwardly from the ground, so you don't actually have to be able to put something in orbit in order to be able to hold a satellite at risk. So that kind of technology, the United States and the Soviet Union and China have all demonstrated the ability to destroy a satellite on orbit, and well, all three have done that.
Well, I wonder about commercial satellites. Would AT&T be tempted to shoot down Verizon satellites?
Well, I think it's not in their best interest. Companies tend to not do things that are not in their best interest. And I think almost all satellite operators agree that a set of norms and rules about not interfering with satellites is to their best interest, because satellites are inherently quite vulnerable. And so if you instead you say, well, it is the Wild West and every satellite for itself, satellites are very hard to defend. So whether you get some advantage from targeting somebody else, you're vulnerable yourself, and so you have to weigh those risks. And again, as I mentioned, any time a satellite gets destroyed on orbit, that debris stays in orbit as well. And so anything the size of even a marble up at the speeds of orbit could destroy a satellite. So, you know, the destruction of one large satellite on orbit can essentially double the amount of dangerous debris in low Earth orbits. So it's not in anyone who wants to use space's interest to start a shooting war.
How much information has been made public about what some of the satellites are doing? Do we know what military and intelligence gathering satellites are capable of?
Pretty good guesses. So that is one special thing about space, is that it's very hard to disguise that you're up there. You know, there are instances where launches, I mean, certainly a space launch itself is a spectacular event. So anyone would notice that something had been launched. Once you're in orbit, there are some ways to disguise a satellite and try to keep them covert. And a country might manage that for a while, but one cannot count on having your satellite be unnoticed. That is different, though, knowing that something is there and has not, you don't know its purpose. That's different than knowing everything that it can do. But you certainly can estimate the resolution of an optical telescope, for example, by just being able to observe the diameter of its mirror. So we know, you know, bits about the limitations of technology. And so, for example, you can look at the maps produced by some of the commercial satellite imaging companies, and those are very, very good. And one can assume, for example, the United States military, which has enormous sums of money at its disposal, probably can do a bit better. So there are good educated guesses you can make.
I can't wait until Google winds up mapping outer space. The idea of internet in space has been posited. I'm going to take a little break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you about that, Jonathan. And we'll also talk about the Chandra X-ray Observatory. Perhaps we'll get to Newt Gingrich's plans for going to the moon and Mars. And we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment or a question on our show page at WNYC.org. We are back with Dr. Jonathan McDowell, an astrophysicist at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, which is part of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Dr. Laura Grego, an astrophysicist and senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's the co-author of a book called Securing the Skies and the Physics of Space Security. Our number here, 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org if you have any questions about space satellites. Jonathan, I've read about the idea of an internet in space that is a system of satellites or a constellation of satellites that would communicate with each other, creating an internet between them. Is that possible with the current technology?
Absolutely. And satellite-to-satellite communication has already been demonstrated for many years. We already have a lot of, you know, the internet actually does get transmitted via satellite as it is.
Is that what the cloud comes from?
Where
it resides?
It's one component. You can do it a lot of different ways. And so the idea is that you could have a more robust constellation that if you distribute the tasks among a bunch of different satellites, if one of them dies, you know, you can fail over and have something that doesn't mind if you have the occasional problem.
Let's take a couple of calls. We go now to Joe from Jersey City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, Joe.
Is this Leonard?
Yes. You can talk, Joe.
I, believe it or not.
We're doing it by satellite, Joe.
What's that?
Nothing.
Person to see Sputnik.
You're sure of that?
What's that?
You're sure of that?
Absolutely.
Where were you at the time?
I was lying on the ground in Vermont while my parents were doing some school work. They were teachers on a Saturday, and my father had been in the Air Force, so I was fascinated. Jets were new. There weren't many overhead, and I happened to see something go over way too fast with no noise, no jet trail, which freaked me out. I ran in. I drew this picture of a thing on the, this little circle on the board with light flashing off, and said to my father, "What was this?" He said, "I have no idea." So, well, the military's up to something because there've been a lot of things invented.
So, Laura, do you think that that's
before I could tell my friends? They announced Sputnik, and there was a picture like I'd drawn by coincidence, as it turns out. There was this thing.
Well, so let me ask my guest, Laura, would Vermont have been the best place to spot Sputnik?
Leonard, I can't answer that. I have no idea, but Jonathan might.
Well, it's certainly true that in the early days after the Sputnik launch, you were able to see it from various parts of the United States. It's possible that what the listener saw was actually Sputnik's final rocket stage, which was a long, thin cylinder that was tumbling end over end, and it was actually much brighter than the tiny little Sputnik satellite itself. Because whenever you launch a satellite, you don't just put the satellite in orbit, you put part of the rocket in orbit as well.
Now, Jonathan, aren't you part of the team that supports the Chandra X-ray Observatory? Can you tell us a bit about that project?
Right. So Chandra is a satellite that's much higher up than even these geostationary satellites that we've been talking about. And it's a space telescope. I think of it as sort of the younger brother of the Hubble. And while the Hubble looks at ordinary stars and galaxies out in the universe, Chandra looks at X-rays, and so it sees all the weird stars and galaxies. It sees black holes. It sees exploding stars. And so we've been operating that now for over 10 years here at the Harvard-Smithsonian. And really every day we're looking at a different strange object in space and sending back new pictures of it.
That sounds really exciting. I guess it makes the loss of the Hubble a little easier to take. But the Hubble can do certain things that Chandra can't do. Isn't that true?
That's right. You need different kinds of space telescope. So the Hubble can see very well in the ultraviolet. It can take very sharp pictures that are hard to get from the ground. Chandra won't be able to see the same things, but it can see things that are completely invisible to Hubble. And we have a suite of different satellites that are picking apart different parts of the universe, and really you need them all to take the whole picture that we're now developing of an evolving universe, where we're studying things like the elements that are formed when stars explode. You know, all the atoms in your body were made in a stellar explosion, and then the Earth formed out of them. So we're picking apart not only the history of the universe, but filling in the history of the Earth and of our own ancestry, if you like.
Amy from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi. I read, I think, a few years ago that the funding for climate monitoring satellites was being cut, at least ones from the U.S., just when we need the most. And I was wondering, has that been restored, or what's the situation now?
Well, there were some cutbacks in climate monitoring satellites, but there's still an extensive series of satellites, and a lot of what we know about climate change comes from NASA's research satellites. We've had a bit of bad luck lately in that the last couple of important satellites to measure carbon and so on went into the ocean instead of getting into orbit. We had some unlucky rocket failures. But there's a huge amount of data still coming back, and I think that aspect of space exploration will only get more important as climate change rises on the national agenda.
Thank you for calling us, Amy.
Thanks.
A listener, John, asks, is there an effort to make countries that launch satellites also responsible for cleaning up the space junk when they die?
That is a great question. There has been, over the last decade, an attempt to come up with guidelines to, as we say, mitigate debris. So to create rules or suggested guidelines, actually, for how you, with proper behavior when you launch. So if you have a low Earth orbiting satellite, and you should have a plan for when it's finished, and have a plan for getting rid of the launch stages that you are finished with after you launch the satellite. So at the end of the life, you should be able to save enough fuel so that you can deorbit them and have them burn up into the atmosphere.
No, I was going to add to that another question, and then you can answer both of them.
Okay.
Moshe on the Upper West Side says, if the satellites have boosters, can't they be used to push them into space away from the Earth forever?
Great question. Yep, and that is part of the solution. Maybe not away from the Earth forever, but out of the part of the orbital space that we use most frequently. So satellites that are at these geostationary orbits that we mentioned, those are quite a bit further away. You know, not the distance between New York and Boston, but, you know, six times the Earth's radius away from the Earth, so really far. But it's heavily used. It's a very heavily subscribed orbit because it's very valuable. And when your satellite is finished, either because, you have to give up your slot for someone else, or it doesn't work anymore, or you've almost run out of fuel, you're supposed to save just enough fuel to lift yourself up out of that band and stay out of everybody else's way. So that's an agreement that's sort of a good behavior agreement, and that's the kind of things that are being constructed right now.
Bill from...
And, of course, you've got to remember that adding that extra fuel adds cost. So, there has to be some regulation in order to encourage people to spend that extra money to make sure that they don't litter.
Well, the next caller, Bill from Long Valley, New Jersey, has a fuel question. Hi, Bill.
How do you do, Leonard? I have I've read about thorium being used as a power source, thorium fission, to keep satellites powered. Are they familiar with it, and would that have any applicability to the continuing energy crisis here on Earth? I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay. Do either of you know about the use of thorium, which has also been posited as an alternative to uranium as a fuel source?
Right. I've heard it suggested. There haven't really been any serious plans to test that out in flight. And really, the whole idea of using nuclear energy as a power source for Earth-orbiting satellites got kind of a bad rap when a Russian nuclear reactor satellite crashed in northern Canada in the 70s and strewed radioactive debris all over Great Slave Lake. So there's been a move away from nuclear power sources, at least in Earth orbit, although some safer kinds of power sources called radioisotope batteries are used on deep space probes like the Voyager, which are going to go in the outer solar system where sunlight is too faint to provide electrical power.
Now, Laura, as I mentioned earlier, you're the co-author of a book called Securing the Skies and the Physics of Space Security. What are the concerns you express in that book?
Well, as I mentioned, we're at this point of where space is being heavily used. There are, you know, over 50 countries invested in it. Many more countries can launch. And satellites have become increasingly valuable, as we've talked about in the show, to conduct of normal, to commerce, to military operations, to communications, to science. And as they become valuable, it's also evident that they're vulnerable. Satellites are easily disrupted and not easily protected. And in the past, as you mentioned, you know, we hearken back to the Star Wars missile defense program, and there have been initiatives over the years as to build weapons that can defend satellites or basically control space for one user to dominate. The United States had some kinds of those plans in the last administration that didn't come to fruition, but plans to build increasing numbers of anti-satellite weapons or space-based weapons. And to be honest, the way that space works, it's not a way. You really require the cooperation of all space users in order to have space be used sustainably and securely. And it really it's not a place that you can control with technological instruments very well. So our concerns were to really push the United States and the international community to come together and really discuss our interest in space and to find ways to make sure that conflicts in space do not become conflicts on the ground, that space is used safely and securely, and hopefully with an eye towards the future, sustainably. And so there has not been a set of discussions for a long time. The place where the last major piece of space law, basically the crown of space law, is the Outer Space Treaty, which was ratified in 1967. It's been 40 years and has had very little elaboration for all the new technologies and the new actors that we have. And so we'd really like to encourage countries to come together. Now, there is initiative been started to build a code of conduct for outer space, which would set out the norms of this is how you should behave in space, this is how you set up a space traffic management system, we all agree not to produce debris, and we all agree not to interfere with each other's satellites. And so that effort was spearheaded by some non-governmental organizations and taken up by the European Union, who produced a draft code of conduct in 2010 and started taking it around to other spacefaring nations. The United States, just earlier this year, announced that in lieu of signing this code of conduct, it would like to spearhead an international code of conduct, a way to bring all countries' voices to the table, all of those with a strong interest in space, and really hammer out a document where all those voices were heard at the outset. And so that's a great hopeful sign.
And we have to leave it on that hopeful sign because we've run out of time. But my great thanks to Dr. Laura Grego, an astrophysicist and senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, co-author of Securing the Skies and the Physics of Space Security, and Dr. Jonathan McDowell, an astrophysicist at the Smithsonian.